Salvador Dali. Thanks for flying Braddock, Mr. Dali.
When you got it, flunked it.
Salvador Dali. Salvador Dali is an original man.
What is it about Salvador Dali, the brilliant surrealist turned canny clown of 20th century art, that keeps us enthralled? Dali stands for the commodification of art, the popularization of art. Dali was the person that knocked art off its pedestal. So Dali had no problem with appearing in TV adverts, for example, be they for chocolate bars, car companies, Alka-Seltzer, or an airline.
Whitey Ford and his new friend Salvador Dali always fly Braniff. They like our food, they like our style, and they like to be on time. Thanks for flying Braniff, fellas.
Tell him, Dali, baby.
When you got it, flunked it.
Dali loved and wanted to embrace mass culture. He became the consummate showman. Art critics never forgave him for that. When I was at art school in the 60s, Dali was considered a commercial villain, an outcast, a cheap joke. The appalling Mr. Dali was simply not on the menu. But now there are shows all the time. Tate Modern recently featured Dali in film, and the Victoria and Albert Museum in London exhibited many of Dali's objects and designs in a show called Surreal Things. After all, Dali was the man who gave the world the famous shoe hat, the gloves with fingernails, the skeleton dress, glasses with windscreen wipers, who made for his eccentric English patron, Edward James, a rubber-lined room that breathed like the inside of an animal. And, of course, that famous lobster telephone.
It was actually an operating telephone. The bottom part is a traditional telephone, and the top part is a plastic or a resin reconstruction of a lobster. And they came in different colourways. In fact, Edward James commissioned 12 of them, 6 white and 6 black and orange.
This is Ghislaine Wood, expert in surrealism at the V&A.
Salvador Dali realises the sort of commercial potential of the object. So in the exhibition, we have extraordinary things like the aphrodisiac jacket, which was this piece that was exhibited at the first Surrealist Object Exhibition in 1936. And it really is an extraordinary piece because it is a jacket covered in little glasses. And in the exhibition, a bottle of creme de menthe was placed in front of it, and the visitor was encouraged to take the glass off the jacket, fill it with creme de menthe, and get slowly drunk in front of it. Your perceptions of it were changed through alcohol. I mean, he obviously is extremely important in the sense that he developed the idea of artist as sort of persona. I mean, you can't imagine sort of Andy Warhol existing without Salvador Dali. And I think Dali is rather underestimated. I mean, a lot of the works in this exhibition are some of the most creative examples of design, let alone art.
So just what is the continuing appeal of the appalling Mr. Dali? I've come to Dali Land, to northeastern Spain, to trace the roots of art's most monstrous, perverse, and outrageous talent. Dali grew up here in the town of Figueres, the son of a notary. He was a spoiled child, a brat, a little like me, treated nevertheless like a young prince.
Had this towering ego. You know, he always wanted to assert himself, he always wanted to differentiate himself from the common herd, and was quite strategic about this right from the beginning.
Louisa Buck is a journalist, an art historian, who's made a special study of the Surrealist movement.
His childhood was overshadowed by the fact that he had this dead brother, also called Salvador, who died just 9 months before he'd been born. So his parents almost believed that he was the reincarnation of this dead child, who apparently he uncannily resembled as well, his namesake. So, of course, he was acutely aware of how precious he was, how his parents didn't want any harm to befall him, so he could get away with murder and behave in the most outrageously tantrumy, flamboyant, difficult way, and did, by all accounts. So you've got this already, this sort of very attention-seeking, highly intelligent, febrile child. Also, there's a whole genetic kind of history of instability in the family. His grandfather committed suicide. His father apparently was prone to mood swings, rather irrational behaviour. So, you know, it's all there in the DNA, basically.
Dali said At the age of 6, I wanted to be a female cook. At 7, I wanted to be Napoleon. And my ambition has steadily grown ever since.
On top of the house in Figueres, there was a terrace with an abandoned washing house, and his father said that he could have that as his territory. He was 12 at the time. So, where there was a tub, and he said it was very hot, he'd put the tap on and sit there naked in the tub sketching. He also says in his memoirs that he used to dress up as a king because one of his uncles or aunts or something had given him a present of a crown and a sort of ermine robe, and that he would stalk around naked around his territory, his domain on top of the house. So that's very important. He said, from then on, Dalí always wanted to be at the top of everything, at the top of the ladder, at the top. He actually, in his diary, says, you know, I'm going to go to Madrid to study, and then I'm going to go to Rome, and when I come back from Rome, I'm going to be a genius.
Ian Gibson is the author of the definitive biography of the artist, The Shameful Life of Salvador Dali. For all his antics, young Dali was timid, and certainly frightened of girls and sex.
I think there came a moment where either he committed suicide or else constructed another personality, and that is what he did, which is brilliant, with layer upon layer of mask and deceit. And in his diary, he says, you know, I'm completely fake. My life is a pose. I'm only thinking about what people are thinking about me. He writes like that at the age of 17. It's fantastic. Life is a farce, and I'm an actor in this farce. And he never changed. He just got better and better at being Dalí. And, of course, it all really happened when he decided to use the third person to talk about himself as Dalí does not believe, and Dalí is the man who knows, Dalí is a genius, Dalí, Dalí, Dalí.
But as a young surrealist, Dalí was a genius, wasn't he? Louisa Buck.
There's a kind of checklist of quintessential Dalí works made between sort of 1926-27 up to 1937-8-9, you know, which one sees as his kind of definitive body of work. Lugubrious Game, The Great Masturbator, The Persistence of Memory, The Spectre of Sex Appeal, The Birth of Liquid Desires, the titles themselves conjure up, you know, all these fantastically sort of finely wrought, molten Dali-esque forms with strange obsessive details and extraordinary empty landscapes, Intimation of the Spanish Civil War. I mean, you've got all these great works. But for me, I think The Great Masturbator of 1929, I mean, even the title's transgressive, you know, and here you've got this extraordinary, molten, kind of sandy, rock form, which of course makes the profile of Dali himself balancing on his nose, but is also of course the rocks of Cadaqués as well. The terrible sort of grasshopper sitting squatting over where the Dali mouth would be, and then rising out of the sort of neck is this sort of Art Nouveau Belle Epoque female profile, which is resting her nose against these shrouded genitals of a man in underpants. I mean, the whole thing is so kinky and strange and obsessive. He was steeped in Freud. You know, this is his own psychological landscape here being formed. And it is in a style that is absolutely immutably Dali-esque. One might have seen it on the wall of a million student bedrooms. It's a cliche in itself almost, but nonetheless, nobody else did it like him.
Here we are on the shore of this rocky coastline, 40 minutes drive over the mountains from Figueres. This place, Port Lligat, was obviously very important to Dali throughout his entire life. Not just because he had a house here that became his court, but because the cliffs and boulders stirred his imagination. He'd morph all these shapes I'm looking at right now into kind of the head of a dog, the body of a tiger, just like a filmmaker might use a dissolve. Dali used to just stand here, just where I am, on the shoreline, and watch the sun's movement across the rocks outside, waiting for what he called the monsters to emerge. He could slip somehow between the real world and hallucination, using what he called critical paranoia, a kind of carefully cultivated delirium in which he could trawl the subconscious and be aware of himself at the same time. Dali's photographic precision as a painter helped obviously and enabled him exactly to transcribe those dream images in a way that absolutely put him on a par with all the great painters.
Dali's house and studio in Port Lligat was once a collection of fishermen's cottages. But he and Gala, Dali's lifelong companion and muse, turned it into a kind of cabinet of curiosities.
It's strange. We're now in this room full of optical illusion and all sorts of strange gadgetry. But there on the wall is a fashion statement based and rooted in moustaches. Moustaches on very, very important folk. Joseph Stalin, smack in the middle, and to the left, Kaiser Wilhelm, and to the right, Philip IV by Velasquez. Obviously, this moustache is playing a very important part on Salvador Dali's image.
My moustache, contrarily, is very gay, very pointed, very aggressive.
Do you have any trouble with it at night? I mean, do you have to pick it or anything like that, or does it stand up at night?
No, in the night, clean every night. Mm. They come in soft.
And then in the morning, up she goes again.
3 minutes. Only in 3 minutes, fix my moustache.
And then you feel you can face the world with that wonderful moustache standing up.
Dali's carefully waxed moustache was the instantly recognisable logo of Dali, the brand. Here we're in Gala's closet, and underneath glass are hosts and hosts and hosts and numbers of different photographs of Dali and Gala. Dali and Gala's famous friends, Dali and Gala with Harpo Marx, Coco Chanel, Laurence Olivier, Brendan Behan, Marcel Duchamp, Pablo Picasso, Christian Dior, composers of the day, and other painters and poets. And over on the wall, the covers of 101 magazines, Dali in different phases of his cultivation of his moustache, obviously his greatest fashion accessory. High up on top of the labyrinth where I've been of fishermen cottages lies nothing else but a strange olive grove, a garden to the king, Dali. A place whose centrepiece is nothing other than a phallus-shaped swimming pool. At the end of the swimming pool, a sort of temple whose centrepiece is the glass top of the local lighthouse. There are cypress trees, and amongst it all, there is all this kind of bric-a-brac that could have been picked up if you were at the Porte de Clignancourt flea market in Paris or the Portobello Road back in the 1950s. There are big, giant plastic Michelin men, the sort of people that appear to you when you were driving your Simca or little Ford car to the garage. There's Pirelli ads that look like something out of a James Rosenkiss 1960s pop art exhibition. And in the centre of it, there's a Schiaparelli hot pink May West sofa made out of fiberglass. Dotted amongst us, there are these Moorish fountains. It looks like the imagination of a madman, and you'd wonder, who on earth and how on earth did people react when they came here, desperately, desperately trying to do deals to get the king to sign an autograph here, an autograph here, to make all kinds of industrialized products with his name attached to it. This was the place where Salvador Dali became Dali, the king of brand art. One visitor was Robert Whittaker, a young Englishman who photographed Dali over several years and who'd been fascinated with the artist since boyhood. They first met right here in the mid-1960s.
As you go in the front door of Dali's house, there's this giant stuffed bear. But it wasn't the bear that embraced me. It was Dali with these wonderful musical kisses. He'd sort of be singing and whistling whilst he's kissing you. The period of time that I knew him, he was being managed by Captain Peter Moore. And Dali and Peter would dream up these money-making ideas, making a set of tiles or cufflinks or hundreds and hundreds of things. He designed a series of scent bottles based around the scrotum, and because Dali would always say to me, well, this is where the whole of life begins, it's in the scrotum. And consequently, he made a swimming pool in the shape of a penis, and I've got pictures of him swimming around in the testicles, and he's singing, literally, this is where life begins. This was a major money-making design, and some of those bottles are quite, as far as I'm concerned, they're beautiful pieces. People would be coming by appointment. If he would paint a label for a champagne bottle, well, there was no fee involved. There was champagne for life. A Canadian film company would come and say, well, we want to make a film with you. And Peter Moore would say, well, it's $1 million. And they'd walk away. And then they'd come back and say, OK, we'll do it. And then Dali would say, well, I'm not going to do it. So Peter Moore's got $1 million sat there and Dali's not coming out of his room. I think it just all became a game of money.
Dali's world had changed when he went to America in the late 30s. He'd been chucked out of the increasingly left-wing surrealist movement. Its leader called Dali a toilet paper revolutionary and coined a cruel anagram of his name, Avida Dollars.
Pennsylvania saves 5,000.
In America, he was certainly determined to be rich and famous, working on ballets, designing sets and costumes. He designed jewellery, the packaging for Schiaparelli's perfume, shocking, designed Helena Rubinstein's apartment, and he was at the centre of art happenings.
He has just thrown a bunch of gold paint, which has not only hit me in the face, but has gone across the canvas to the applause of the crowd below. 12 homing pigeons have just flown out of the canvas. Maestro, what are you doing?
When he first came to America, he did shop windows. He paraded himself around. He had an entourage. All his kind of outrageous antics went into overdrive, of course, aided and abetted by Gala, stuffing dollars into her handbag. So you have this sort of sense of the artist, if you like, as a kind of money-making machine, happy to kind of apply the alchemy of art to anything he found.
At the New York Universal Fair, just before the war, Dali designed what was called the Dream of Venus Pavilion. Manuel Sevillano of the Dali Foundation.
He comes up with this most surrealistic pavilion that had naked sirens, beautiful girls floating in tanks of water with live sea plants floating in it, and all these fantastic creations in this pavilion, which basically a pavilion paid for by a tire company. He does things to see the effect on people.
And in 1946, Dali went to Hollywood.
I can't make out just what sort of a place it was. It seemed to be a gambling house.
Dali worked with Alfred Hitchcock, designing the dream sequences in the film Spellbound. The movie starred Gregory Peck as a murder suspect, suffering from amnesia. Ingrid Bergman was the psychiatrist trying to cure him.
And then a girl came in with hardly anything on and started walking around the gambling room, kissing everybody.
It was the first movie, I think, to actually acknowledge psychoanalysis as a kind of valid practice of actually plumbing the dream world and curing madness and exploring those kind of avenues. So Hitchcock very much wanted Dali to be involved, because what he didn't want Hitchcock was some kind of cliched, woozy, hazy sort of filmic way of showing dreams as it always had been in the past, when always the screen goes wobbly and suddenly they're off into dream world. And the bits that do come through, I think, still do show a very remarkable, and we're talking the 1940s, you know, very remarkable vision for a mainstream filmmaker to use an artist like Dali, although Hitchcock was also no slouch on the publicity front. He knew that if he used Dali, it would get a great deal more publicity for the film.
I requested Dali. Selznick, the producer, had the impression that I wanted Dali for the publicity value. Wasn't it at all? What I was after was the vividness of dreams. As you know, all Dali's work is very solid and very sharp, with very long perspectives and black shadows. Actually, I wanted the dream sequences to be shot on the back lot, not in the studio at all. I wanted them shot in the bright sunshine, so the cameraman would be forced to what we call stop down and get a very hard image. This was, again, the avoidance of the cliché. All dreams in movies are blurred. It isn't true. Dali was the best man for me to do the dreams, because that's what dreams should be.
Suddenly I was running. Then I heard something beating over my head. It was a great pair of wings. The wings chased me and almost caught up with me when I came to the bottom of the hill. That's all there was. I woke up and saw Dr. Brulot.
Have some coffee.
Thanks.
This is Matthew Gale, curator of film at Tate Modern.
Film was appealing to Dali.
because it was a mass entertainment. It was entertainment on an industrial level. And he, particularly in the late 20s, was concerned with doing away with the pretensions of avant-garde art. And he saw the films of people like Buster Keaton and Charlie Chaplin as really the pinnacle of that combination of an industrial output, but just marvellous technique, and immersing the whole public in the extraordinary fantasy of these films.
Dali had made two surreal films with Brunel back in the 1920s. One got banned instantly, and the other opened with the notorious scene in which a woman's eyeball appears to be sliced with a razor. But in America, Dali discovered the world of cartoon animation. "I have found," he wrote, "the greatest surrealist in America. His name is Walt Disney." Walt, though, was clearly already familiar with Dali's work.
If one looks at Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, one can see sort of Dalinian aspects to the nightmarish qualities, particularly in the sequence in which Snow White gets lost in the woods. I think Disney saw in Dali a creative mind that he could harness, he could draw in. Dali's particular genius for mixing images, for overlaying them, for allowing images to emerge one from the other. So they became very friendly when Disney commissioned Dali to work on Destino in 1946.
Destino follows a female dancer as she dances through surreal scenery inspired by Dali's paintings. It could have been a classic, but it was abandoned at the time for financial reasons. And it was left to Roy Disney to finish the film in 2003. Dali's attention had moved on and back to Spain. Bob Whittaker.
His mind, I think, was totally involved in how he could get hold of this huge building in Figueres and put his works in it and turn it into a magnificent observatory of Dali. And he was interested in people like Buckminster Fuller, so there's a Bucky Fuller dome on the top of it. But I know Dali is very much in the basement. And I visited him recently and left him a glass of champagne.
Ima Parada of the Dali Foundation takes me to Dali's Mad Castle, now one of the most popular museums in Spain.
Amphitheatre. Wow, wow, wow. Oh, my God.
This is the place where Dali asked to be buried, under our feet, looking at the centre of the dome. He wanted to be just a brick of this museum. That was his biggest and largest surrealist object in itself.
This is what Damien Hirst is trying to build in Wales. Did you know Damien Hirst is gathering all my early work with Vivian for his creation of a similar kind of mausoleum, an old ancient rock pile he's bought in Wales, similar to this mausoleum here in Figueres of Salvador Dali?
It used to be the old theatre of the city. He said that he wanted the spectator to have a theatrical experience.
Well, we definitely are having a theatrical experience, or at least I am. This giant awning, canvas, painting, whatever you call it, draped and framed with this red velvet curtain, and all these kind of gold lacquered statues in all these tiny little windows in this circular wall reminds me of something very Roman, very ancient, and the walls sort of covered with ivy. But what of the Cadillac car in the middle? That seems a very odd idea.
It has a strong meaning because it's not only an art object, but
no,
it was a real
old-fashioned Cadillac.
Yes. He drove back to Spain from the United States, and so it was a way of showing people that he had succeeded, and so he was acknowledged as such.
Because of it being a Cadillac, he came back as like a rich millionaire. Yeah,
and of course he showed that he had succeeded. So he placed a driver and two other figures inside, meaning Gala and himself, being driven by the taxi driver.
Yes.
And if you put a coin in that machine, it rains inside the car.
Is that the idea of the rainy taxi?
Yes,
was
that's
that
right.
Part of his surrealist exhibition back in the 30s? Mm-hmm. Okay, here we go, rainy taxi. That's what Salvador Dali called this, and here it goes, all the water pouring out. A light inside, Dali looking like some skeletal, not very attractive figure, even though once upon a time he was a handsome devil. And there's Gala completely naked, and some young boy toy driving the car in front. Wow. Dali was this paradigm of a showbiz decline. You know, the reclusive celebrity surrounded by poisonous acolytes who are all fleecing him, and he loses control. He's not able to control what his output is anymore. He's very unwell. Nobody can get to him. It all becomes rather grotesque. The demise of this great flamboyant icon. And I think, you know, things did disintegrate horribly at the end of his life in the way that it has done with so many other major celebrities. One thinks of Elvis or whoever. It's a kind of showbiz cliche almost.
In the end, Salvador Dali, the brilliantly accomplished anti-artist, the carefully branded celebrity, the unrepentant showman, didn't quite make it into the world of modern pop culture. He wanted that vast audience, but somehow he was rooted in old world traditions, his seaside studio, his fairground museum. For all the scandal of Dali signing blank pieces of paper at the end of his life, he couldn't get into mass production with his work. But he'd opened a huge door and ushered in the age of Andy Warhol and our generation of British conceptual artists who have no problem whatever with fame or money.
Alka-Seltzer is a work of art, truly one of a kind, like Dalí.